Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 56.
Our travelers, Tang Monk, Sun Wukong, Zhu Baji, Sha Wu Jing, and the horse.
They're back on the road, right? This is just after they dealt with that that scorpion demon.
Yeah, quite the ordeal that was. And the text tells us it's high summer. Specifically, it mentions the Duan Yu around the Duan Wu festival time.
And the description, at first, it's just lovely, really peaceful.
It really is. You get these warm breezes, the smell of wild orchids, bamboo feeling cool after rain. Very evocative.
It even mentions festival stuff, right? Like mugwort and calamus, hints of sticky rice dumplings, dragon boats, things happening elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly. It paints this picture of, well, momentary peace, natural harmony.
Which, of course, in Journey to the West, never lasts long.
Ha! No kidding. And sure enough, boom! Huge mountain blocks their path.
In Tripitaka's first reaction.
Instant fear. The text says something like, he's worried, thinking, oh no, monsters again. He gets all cautious.
That the disciples, totally different vibe.
Oh yeah. They basically just brush it off. Like, hey, we're committed Buddhists now. What's there to fear? You know?
It's a neat little contrast, isn't it? Shows where their heads are at, spiritually maybe?
Definitely. Tripitaka's still got those earthly anxieties clinging to him.
And this isn't just some little hill either. The description makes it sound immense.
Oh, yeah, totally forbidding. Sounds all, oh, shucks, 10,000 yards high, sheer cliffs, that kind of imagery.
And the path?
Yeah.
Basically non-existent. You can barely walk 10 steps without stumbling.
Right. Super rugged terrain. Really emphasizes the physical struggle. And the text fills it out with wildlife sounds, too. Foxes, deer, apes, tigers roaring, cranes.
Wild plum blossoms, apricots, lots of wild grass and flowers, too. They are deep in the wilderness.
Absolutely. So they manage to cross this beast of a mountain somehow.
And they finally reach a flat bit of land, the text calls it.
Uh-huh. And here comes this funny little bit about the horse. Pigsy decides he's going to hurry things up.
Right. He tries to get the horse moving faster.
Yeah. So yeah. He grabs his rake, starts whacking the horse.
Yeah.
But nothing. The horse just keeps walking slowly.
Huh. So brute force doesn't work on the dragon horse.
Apparently not for Pigsy, anyway. Then Monkey steps in.
And what does he do?
Simple. Just shakes his golden staff for the Just Dog One about. And the horse takes off like a shot. Like an arrow. Instant obedience.
Wow. So why does the horse listen to Monkey like that?
Well, the text gives this great explanation. It digs into Monkey's backstory. Remember his job in heaven?
Oh, right. He was the stable boy.
Exactly. Keeper of the Imperial Horses. And because of that, the story says all horses everywhere are inherently afraid of monkeys. It's this weird, specific piece of lore.
That's amazing. These little details are just gold. It connects the big cosmic stuff with, like, everyday travel problems.
Totally. It makes the world feel so much richer. And the horse, apparently, keeps up this mad dash for about 20 li, so maybe 6 or 7 miles.
Before it slows down again.
Yeah, when they reach cultivated land, it's like the speed was tied to the wildness they just left.
Okay, so things are calming down again. Maybe?
We'd think so. But just as they reach this cultivated area, they hear a gong.
Uh-oh. That doesn't sound good.
Nope. Ambush. Suddenly, from the sides of the road, over 30 bandits pop out.
Armed.
Yep. Seize, spears, swords, clubs, the works, blocking the road completely.
And Tripitaka. How does he react this time?
Absolute terror. But it's different from the monster fear, maybe more. Immediate. The text says he's trembling, actually falls off the horse.
Falls off.
Wow. Yeah, and immediately starts begging. Oh, great king, spare my life. Just pure panic.
It's interesting that human bandits scare him that much, maybe even more than demons.
It seems like it, yeah. And the two leaders, the text goes to town describing them, super vivid.
Give us a taste.
Okay, like Lakud Blueface, fangs that defy the gods, spooshing as bulging eyes like a death omen.
Yikes.
Then you've got Jisui red hair, like fire at their temples, hoob yellow beards like needles under their chins, dressed in tiger skins, wolf tooth clubs, classic scary bandit look.
Okay, so they look the part. What do they want?
Straight up money. Travel funds. They actually say, you know, give us some money and we won't hurt you.
So Tripitaka tries to reason with them.
He does. Gets up, explains who he is sent by the Tang Emperor to get scriptures. But he says he's broke. It's been years. Money's gone. He lives by begging Tripafor. Just ask them to let him pass.
How does that go over?
About as well as you'd expect. They're like, nope. We set up here specifically to get Kashgok Fool. If you have no money, give us your clothes and the white horse.
The clothes and the horse. But Tripitaka's road is special to him, isn't it?
It is. And surprisingly, he pushes back here. He refuses to give up the robe, saying it was patched together from donations of Pali. He says giving it up would, quote, kill him.
Wow, that's strong. Does he stop there?
No, he even tries to lecture them. Says robbing people like this means they'll get bad karma, be reborn as animals.
Preaching to angry bandits. Bold move.
Yeah, well, it just makes them angrier. They move to beat him up. And the text gives us this little insight into his mind. He thinks briefly about his disciples and their power. Like, maybe they could handle this.
A flicker of hope. Or maybe just delegation.
Maybe. But the bandits don't wait. Clubs are raised. And this is where Tripitaka, who the text notes has never told a lie.
He breaks.
He does. Out of sheer desperation. He decides he has to tell a lie.
What's the lie?
He tells him he has a young disciple following behind who does have some silver tie and should be there any minute.
Clever. Buying time.
Yeah.
Do the bandits buy it?
They do. They decide, okay, let's wait for this kid with the cash. Let's tie him up for now.
Tie him up? Where?
High up in a tree.
Yeah.
Just leaves him dangling there.
Oh, the indignity. Poor Tripitaka.
Right. So eventually, the disciples catch up.
And what do they see?
Well, Pixie sees Tripitaka hanging in the tree and just bursts out laughing. Then he thinks the master's climbed up to, like, play on a swing, or straw with long kalanchi.
Oh, Pixie. Always reliable for comic relief.
Totally. But Monkey, of course, gets it instantly. Stop talking nonsense. Master's tied up there.
So Monkey takes charge.
Yeah. Tells Pigsy and Sandy to wait. He'll check it out. And as soon as he sees the bandits, his reaction is priceless.
What does he think?
Secret delight. Secret delight. What luck. Business has come knocking. He sees this as an opportunity.
Huh. Such a contrast to Tripitaka's terror. So does he just wade in fighting?
Nope. He uses his brain, transforms.
Into what?
Into a servant. A clean young monk. Looks about 16.
Yeah.
Wearing a simple black robe and yen, carrying a blue cloth bag over his shoulder, the white man.
The perfect disguise. Innocent looking and carrying the money Tripitaka promised.
Exactly. So he walks up all innocent, like, hey, what's going on here?
And Tripitaka sees him.
Oh, yeah. And immediately starts yelling for rescue.
Does Monkey just rescue him?
Not without some teasing first. Even in disguise, he gives Tripitaka a hard time. He asks about the business, compares Tripitaka unfavorably to other monks he knows, calls him no good for getting scared.
Classic Monkey. Still finding the humor in it?
Right. He even reminds Tripitaka that his job is to get to Buddha, not give away the valuable dragon horse.
So Tripitaka has to explain the lie.
Yeah, he admits he lied because they were about to beat him, just trying to buy some time.
And Monkey's response to basically being offered up as the solution.
Pure Monkey, he jokes, thanks for promoting me. This is exactly how you should supply me. Then adds, if you could supply me like this 70 or 80 times a month, I'd have even more business.
Ah, loves a good fight, doesn't he? So the bandits approach the disguised Monkey.
Yep, they surround him, demanding the silver Tripitaka mentioned.
And Monkey plays along.
Absolutely. Says, sure, got the money right here in my bag. He even specifies amounts.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Mentions about 20 ingots of Ias horse hoof gold and 20 or 30 ingots of Kona silver powder. Plus some scattered silver he hasn't counted. Offers them the whole bag.
Wow. Sounds convincing. Does he ask for anything?
Just one condition. Untie his master and don't hurt him.
And he throws in some philosophy.
He does. Quotes a proverb. Uis. Virtue is fundamental. Wealth is secondary. Kind of downplays the money. Says monks can always get more donations anyway. It's a masterful performance.
Do the bandits fall for it?
Hook, line, and sinker. They're pleased. They even say, that old monk was stingy, but this young monk is generous.
They agree to untie Tripitaka.
Okay, so rescue successful. What happens next?
This is maybe the most surprising part. The second Tripitaka's feet hit the ground.
Yeah.
He doesn't wait, doesn't thank Monkey, doesn't look around. He leaps onto the horse, didn't even care about Wukong, grabs the whip and just bolts.
Bolts where? Towards the west. Nope, back the way they came. Just pure panic flight away from the scene.
Oh my goodness. He just runs away from his rescuer.
Totally focused on escape.
And Wukong sees this. He's still there with the bandits, sees his master racing off in the wrong direction, and yells out, you know, "Master, wrong way."
This Tang San Zhang, he just keeps going, panic mode.
So the master's making a run for it. Wukong's left, facing these bandits.
And they turn to him. Okay, the monk got away, but surely this monkey-looking guy has something. They demand travel money.
And Wukong's reaction is just perfect, Wukong. He doesn't even look worried. He actually laughs.
He does. He tells them, basically, money? I don't have any. How about you give me some?
Predictably, that doesn't sit well. The bandits are furious. One guy grabs a big stick.
Yeah, like a cudgel, and starts whacking Wukong on the head with it. Hard. Over and over.
But Wukong,
yeah,
he just stands there. Takes it. It's like hitting rock.
It's incredible. He even kind of compliments the guy. Says he's hitting well. You know, keep it up.
Uh-huh. Tells them they could hammer away until next year's spring drumming. And he wouldn't even feel it. Just taunting them.
The bandits are just stunned, calling him hardhead. They can't figure it out.
And that's when Wukong decides, okay, playtime's over. He reaches up to his ear.
That classic move. Everyone knows this bit.
And pulls out what looks like a tiny little needle, like an embroidery needle.
Which is, of course, his Rui Jingu Bang, his magic staff, shrunk down.
He holds this little needle out to the bandits. Like, here you go.
They're just confused, annoyed. What's this supposed to be?
Then Wukong gives it a little quirl, maybe whispers to it, and poof. It's suddenly this massive, heavy-looking staff. He plants it in the ground.
Right. And he says, you want something valuable? Fine. You can have this if you can lift it.
So two of the main bandit guys, probably feeling pretty tough, step up.
Yeah, they grab hold, brace themselves, heave.
Nothing. Doesn't budge. Not even a tiny bit. The book says it's like a dragonfly trying to shake a stone pillar.
Such a great image. And then we get the why. The text straight up tells us the weight.
13,500 pounds.
13,500. It's not just magic. It's insanely, divinely heavy. No wonder they can't move it.
And then Wukong, after watching them struggle,
just walks over, casually picks it up like it weighs nothing.
Yeah.
Effortless.
And then, just to rub it in, he makes it bigger. Thick as a well railing, it says, and like 70 or 80 feet long.
Yeah, the scale is just immense. He's not messing around now.
No. And with that huge staff, it's over in seconds. One strike for each of the two leaders. Kills them instantly.
And he even throws in a line, like, guess you had bad karma running into me, old son.
Seeing that, the rest of the bandits just drop everything. Yeah. Weapons clang on the ground. They turn and run for their lives. Total terror.
Understandable, really. Threat neutralized.
Okay, so meanwhile, back down the road, Pigsy and Sandy have finally caught up with Tang San Zhang.
Managed to stop him before he ran all the way back to the start, maybe.
And the master's first thought, even after running away, it's still about, well, his principles. He tells Pigsy, go tell Wukong, stick under show mercy. Basically, stop hitting them or, you know, don't kill them.
A bit late for that, master.
Right. So Pigsy, probably grumbling a bit, heads back. He finds Wukong, calls out, hey, where'd those bandits go?
And Wukong's super casual about it. Oh, the others scattered, the two leaders. They're just sleeping here.
Sleeping. Pigsy goes over to check on these sleepers.
And yeah, sees they're very, very obviously dead. Big holes in their heads, the text says.
It's pretty graphic. And Pigsy's horrified. Wukong then makes this, well, this dark joke.
Super dark. Pigsy asks what happened to their heads, and Wukong says something like, oh, I hit out the tofu.
Tofu. Pigsy's confused, like, tofu in their heads.
And Wukong clarifies, no, no, hit out the brains.
Oh.
It's grim humor, but it shows how matter-of-fact Wukong is about this kind of violence. It's just what happens.
Pigsy, probably green around the gills, runs back to the master, reports they're scattered, but the implication is clear. They're dead. Done for.
Tang San Zhang hears this, and he gets genuinely upset. Annoyed, the text says. He starts muttering, goodness gracious. Monkey long, monkey short.
From the master's view.
Exactly. It's demeaning. So Tang San Zhang rides back, sees the bodies, the blood.
And he can't stand the sight. But again, true to his Buddhist path, he wants to do right by the dead, even bandits. He tells Pigsy, dig a grave. We need to bury them so I can pray.
And Pigsy's reaction is classic Pigsy, what me? He killed them. Shouldn't he bury them?
Fair point, maybe. But Wukong doesn't think so.
Nope. Wukong just lifts the staff slightly, glares at Pigsy, calls him a lazy oaf.
Threatens him. Dig now or you get a taste of this staff.
That gets Pigsy moving. He starts digging fast, gets down about 3 feet, thud, hits rock.
Reek's no good. So what does Pigsy do?
He uses his secret weapon, his snout. He apparently just jams his snout into the ground.
And digs another 5 feet with just two thrusts. It's such a weird, specific kind of funny detail. But it gets the job done.
Pigsy's got skills. Unexpected ones.
So, body's buried. Tang Sanzang gets ready to pray. Asks Wukong for incense. Candles. The usual prayer stuff.
And Wukong's just like, Master, look around. We're in the middle of nowhere. Wilderness. Where are we going to get incense? Can't buy it even if we had money. Total pragmatist.
So the master improvises. Dirt for incense. Rocks for offerings.
Yeah.
And he starts the prayer. And this prayer.
Wow.
This is maybe the most revealing part of the whole scene. He starts normally enough, identifies himself, explains the mission, says the bandits attacked.
Says they didn't listen, and Wukong killed them. Standard.
But then he directly addresses the dead bandits and tells them quite explicitly, look, if you're going to complain in the afterlife, complain only about Sun Wukong. He spells it out. His name is Sun. My name is Chin. Different families.
Basically saying he's the one responsible. The debt for your death, it belongs to him. Don't bring this bad karma to me, the scripture pilgrim.
Kind of shocking, right? He's legally, spiritually distancing himself from the whole messy business, making sure the fallout lands squarely on Wukong.
Pigsy hears this and mutters, Master's washed his hands clean. He gets it.
And Kang Sanzang even prays a second time, just to reiterate, complaints go to Wukong only.
So how does Wukong take this? His master basically throwing him under the spectral bus.
He thinks the master is being too unfeeling or maybe lacking loyalty. Like, hey, I just saved you and this is how you repay me.
So Wukong decides, okay, I'll say a prayer too. His style, though.
Which means he walks up to the grave and just hits it three times with his giant iron staff. Thump, thump, thump.
That's his prayer. And then he talks to the dead bandits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tells him, look, your hits earlier didn't even tickle, but you provoked me, so, you know, this happened.
And then the kicker, he tells them, go ahead, complain. Complain anywhere you want, to anyone. Because me, old son, I am absolutely 100% not afraid.
And he explains why he's not afraid. He launches into this incredible boast. It lists everyone important in heaven and hell who basically knows him, fears him, or even works for him.
It's an amazing list, straight from the text. Jade Emperor, Heavenly Kings, the 28 constellations, the 9 luminaries. They all know him or fear him. City gods kneel to him. The Emperor of Mount Tai dreads him.
And get this. The kings of hell. They were his servants back in the day. The rampaging gods of the 5 paths. His juniors.
He finishes by saying, basically anyone in the 3 realms, 5 bureaus, 10 directions, they're all familiar with him. Friends, you might say. Or at least they know better than to cross him.
It's staggering. He's telling these dead guys, go complain to the judges of the underworld. I used to be their boss. There's no one you can go to who holds any sway over me. And Tang Sanzang hears this boast. Hears the sheer scale of Wukong's connections and past. And the text says he's heartstruck.
Yeah, like it finally hits him. The sheer magnitude of the being traveling with him.
So after all that drama, Wukong, practical as ever, just says, okay, that's done. Let's find a place to stay.
But as Tang Sanzang gets back on his horse, the book notes he's harboring resentment, still upset, still processing this real underlying tension, even jealousy among the disciples right then.
Yeah, it uses that phrase, doesn't it? agreeable on the surface, but holding grudges or resentment underneath.
It's such a crucial detail, isn't it?
Baji and Xia Wujing often seem, well, a bit resentful of Wukong.
Maybe his power.
Yeah.
Or his position as the, like, main protector.
Could be. Both, maybe. And their master, Tang Sanzang, he's always struggling with Wukong's very pragmatic, often violent methods versus his own Buddhist ideals.
Right. So they're carrying all that simmering friction, and they just keep going west along the main road.
Yeah, it's just plodding along.
And as evening starts to set in, they spot a farmhouse off to the north. Tang Sanzang decides that's where they'll try and find shelter for the night.
And the source material, it paints this really beautiful, very detailed picture of the rural scene as dusk falls.
Oh, yeah.
It's all, you know, wildflowers, trees, mountains, and water way off in the distance.
Mm.
It creates this feeling of peaceful isolation.
Mm-hmm.
You see the fields they've planted, wheat and things like sunflowers or maybe mallow, the Texas malva.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to see and hear the signs of evening drawing in.
It sounds incredibly atmospheric.
It really is. You get the gulls settling on the dewy reeds, tired birds landing on willows, the constant green of cypress and pine standing out against the fading light. Then the sounds of human life start to emerge. You know, village dogs barking, evening chickens clucking. You see the smoke rising from cooking fires and herdsmen bringing their cattle and sheep back home.
It feels like a deliberate contrast, doesn't it, to the, well, the potential violence they just left behind them on the road? It sort of sets up an expectation of peace and safety.
It does, yeah. But that expectation, it gets challenged almost immediately.
Okay, how?
Well, Tang Sanzang goes up to the farmhouse to ask for lodging. He meets an old man. We find out later his name is Yang.
Right.
And the old man's reaction when he sees the disciples waiting back on the road, it's just immediate, absolute terror.
Oh.
Terrified by their, quote, ugly appearance.
So he doesn't see pilgrims. He sees, what, monsters?
Pretty much. Yeah, he describes them very specifically. One looks like a yaksha, you know, a nature spirit, often fearsome.
Okay.
One like a horse face, an underworld guardian.
Grim Reaper type figure.
Kind of, yeah.
Right.
And one like a thunder god. Legong. These are imposing, often scary figures in Chinese tradition.
Right. Not exactly welcoming figures.
Not at all. And here's where Sun Wukong, ever the provocateur,
oh.
He decides to just, well, amplify the fear.
Sure.
Instead of trying to soothe the poor old man.
Yeah. What does he do?
He loudly boasts that the thunder god is his grandson, the yaksha is his great-grandson, and the horse face. That's his great-great-grandson.
Slight chuckle. Oh, Wukong, seriously.
Seriously. It's deliberately outrageous. It absolutely petrifies the old man. Like, drains the color from his face, makes him want to bolt.
I bet. So Tang Sanzang has to jump in.
Immediately. Tried to explain quickly, you know, no, that's just how they look. They aren't actually demons.
It's a recurring problem for them, isn't it? This whole appearance thing.
Constantly. Their non-human forms just keep provoking fear and misunderstanding in the human world. It forces people to confront their prejudices based purely on looks.
Hmm. And just as Tang Sanzang is trying to smooth things over.
Right then. The old woman, man's wife, comes out. She's got a child with her, their grandson. And she has this moment of just real grounded perspective. She says something like, "You're this scared just seeing ugly people. What would you do if you saw a tiger or a wolf?"
Huh. Good point. Puts it in perspective.
Exactly. She kind of frames his fear against much more tangible, deadly threats. The old man then tells her about Wukong's totally bizarre boast.
Which gives Tang Sanzang another chance to actually clarify properly this time.
Yes. He explains their name, Sun Wukong, Zhu Wunang, that's Baji, of course.
Right.
And Xiao Wujing. And he matches them up to the old man's fearful descriptions. Wukong's the one like the thunder god, Baji like the horse face, and Xiao Wujing like the yaksha.
Okay, making it clear who's who.
And he really stresses, look, they might be ugly, but they are Buddhist disciples. They're followers of a good path, not evil demons.
That distinction must be crucial appearance versus their actual nature and purpose.
Absolutely. And that clarification, it finally seems to work. The old couple calm down, regain their composure.
Ah, good.
They invite the group inside.
Finally. But Tang Sanzang probably still wary after Wukong's stunt.
Oh, for sure.
He gives them a strict instruction first, right? Something like, be respectful, don't act rude.
That's a very necessary warning, especially given Wukong's earlier antics.
Definitely. So, okay, they bring their luggage and the horse inside. And almost immediately, despite the master's warning, we get this perfect little snapshot of the group dynamic. Baji, with his usual vanity, starts claiming he's the handsome, refined one of the group.
Amused. So. Which is, well, let's be honest, objectively not true given his pig-like features.
Exactly. And Wukong, of course, can't resist, jumps right on it, teasing him about his long snout, big ears, ugly face, the works.
Nazik Wukong and Baji.
And poor Xia Wujing, the ever-practical mediator, has to step in and tell them both to just stop arguing and behave themselves.
It's like a little microcosm of their whole journey, isn't it? Even in this quiet domestic setting, their established personalities and frictions just pop right back up.
Totally. But the old couple, they seem genuinely hospitable now.
They do. The wife, she's described as capable or virtuous. She gets busy preparing a vegetarian meal for them.
Nice.
So they eat, and as the evening gets deeper, they settle into a grass hut. There's lamplight, and they start talking.
And Tang Sanzang, being polite, asks the old man his name.
Mr. Yang. And his age, 74.
Then he asks about sons. And this is where the story takes a really sharp, poignant turn, right?
It really does. Mr. Yang reveals he only has one son.
Mm.
And the child they saw earlier, that's his grandson.
Okay.
And then comes this heartbreaking confession about the son. He's not home because, well, he doesn't live an honest life.
What does he do?
He's involved in robbery, banditry, even murder and arson. Associates with bad company. He left 5 days ago and hasn't been seen since.
5 days. And this is the moment that connects everything back, isn't it?
Yes. Tang Sanzang hears this. He has this crucial internal thought. Oh, what does he think?
He immediately wonders if the bandits Wukong killed on the road earlier.
Oh, no.
Were this old man's son and his gang.
Wow. That just lands heavily, doesn't it?
It really does. It starkly links that external threat the pilgrims face on their journey to this deep personal sorrow within what seemed like a peaceful home.
And Tang Sanzang's reaction is just sympathy for the parents.
Profound sympathy. He essentially laments, you know, how could such virtuous parents give birth to such a wicked son?
Yeah, such a contrast. And Wukong, hearing all this, what's his take?
Oh, Wukong, being Wukong, jumps in with his usual directness. No filter.
Let me guess, he offers to fix it.
Yep. Offers to find the son and kill him for the old man. Sees him just as a worthless burden, basically. A straightforward, brutal solution.
Just like that. Find him, kill him, problem solved.
That's Wukong's logic. But old man Yang's response, it's incredibly moving and complex.
He refuses.
He refuses Wukong's offer. Despite everything, all the terrible crimes his son has committed, he is the family's only heir. Mr. Yang explains that even if the son is no good, he's still needed. Needed to carry on the family line. And, crucially, needed to bury him when he dies.
Wow. And how do Baji and Xiao Wujing react to Wukong's generous offer?
With typical pragmatism, very down to earth.
Let me guess. Not our problem.
Pretty much. They tell Wukong not to meddle in affairs that aren't theirs. They remind him, hey, we aren't officials, and the son's actions have nothing to do with us.
Right.
Their focus is much more immediate and, frankly, self-interested. They just ask the old man for some straw so they can sleep. So the old man directs Xiao Wujing to the backyard to get the straw.
Okay.
And tells them they can sleep in the thatched hut out in the garden. Wukong gets the horse settled. Baji brings the luggage.
And they finally settle in for the night. Old man Yang's son, he's a bandit.
Worse than that, his bandit buddies are showing up at the house. The source says they start banging on the door, and the first thing they yell is just about being hungry. You know, hungry, hungry.
Okay, so just basic needs at first. Nothing sinister yet.
Exactly. But that changes fast. As soon as the son finds out who's staying there, his wife mentions the monks, the white horse.
Ah.
The source says the son claps his hands, laughs, and says, shh. Which is basically, what luck? The enemy is right here in my house.
Whoa. Okay, so that switch flips fast. From hunger to revenge.
Instantly. Their goals are suddenly crystal clear. They want the pilgrim's stuff, especially that valuable white horse.
The horse.
But even more, they want payback. They want to avenge their leaders, Wukong beat, before.
And their plan isn't just like a sudden rush. The source makes it sound calculated, almost like chillingly normal in the planning.
It is. They decide, okay, let's eat first. Then sharpen the knives and spears. And then act together. They're prepping for murder, basically.
But someone hears them, right? Thankfully.
Yes, thankfully. Old man Yang. He's a decent guy, completely unlike his son. The source says, yeah, the old man overhears it all.
And he actually wants to help the monks. So he quietly wakes them up, tells them straight up, they know you're here. They plan to kill you.
And tells them to run for it, secretly.
Yeah, urgently. Pack your bags quick. I'll let you out the back door. And and their reactions, Tang Monk must be terrified.
Oh, absolutely. The text says he's trembling, bowing, thanking the old man. Just pure terror.
While the others grab the gear.
Right. Baji gets the horse, Xia sang the luggage, and Wukong naturally grabs his staff, ready for anything.
And they sneak out. The old man lets them go, goes back to bed like nothing happened.
Yeah, narrow escape.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not quite.
No.
You'd think they're clear, right? But the bandits finish eating, finish sharpening their weapons. This is around 5 a.m.
Okay.
They go to find the monks, and they're gone.
Yeah.
And
the back door gives it away.
Yay.
That's the one dead giveaway. And that just ignites them. They let out this huge shout, ooh, and chase after the monks like arrows. Yay. They are determined to catch them. Ooh, wow, they're fast too. The source says they chase until sunrise, before they even spot them.
Yeah, they finally catch sight of him, and Tang Monk sees them coming.
Panic stations, I bet.
Total panic. The bandits are here. What do we do? he knows he's helpless.
And Wukong steps up, naturally, confident as ever.
Always. Don't worry, old son here will take care of them.
But this is the moment, isn't it? The crucial instruction from Tang Monk.
Absolutely pivotal. Before Wukong can do anything, Tang Monk lays down the law, his moral line. The source quotes him directly. Wukong, do not injure people. Just scare them off. That's enough.
He's pleading for nonviolence, even now.
But Wukong, he's not having it, is he? He knows these guys aren't just going to be scared off.
Nope. The source is really blunt about it. Wukong just wasn't willing to listen. Flat out refuses.
So he turns back.
Turns right back. To face them alone, they immediately surround him. Chi Man Si! And they're attacking with everything. Si, me to kill him!
And Wukong's response. The prescription is pretty intense, isn't it? Even for him against, you know, regular bandits.
It's brutal. He shakes his staff. Ah! It gets thick as a bowl. Ning! And then it's just carnage. The descriptions are so vivid. They're, oh, scattered like stars falling from the sky.
Anyone the staff touches directly. Dead. Dead along. Just brushed by it. Dead. Your heart. Broken bones. Even scraped. Injured skin. Suck.
So it's total annihilation. Not just defending, but obliterating.
Exactly. It says only a few clever ones got away. The rest, they all went to see King Yama. A complete slaughter.
And Tang Monk sees this. Sees Utu. How does he react?
He's horrified. Utterly horrified. The source says he's panicking, spurring his horse west, just trying to get away from the sight. Beji and Sha Seng follow him. He just can't watch.
But Wukong, he's not finished. He does something else, something specific.
Yeah, this is the part that really pushes it over the edge. He turns to the survivors, the injured bandits, and asks them point blank, which one is old Yang's son?
No, he singled out the son of the man who saved them.
That's exactly what he does. They point him out, the one in yellow.
And then Wukong. Oh, boy.
Then Wukong does the unthinkable. The source describes it starkly. He grabs a knife from one of them, cuts off the son's head, Denjai, and just carries it, dripping blood, as he goes to catch up with Tang Monk.
Oh, wow. Bringing the head back. That's not just killing. That's making a statement. A really provocative one.
Deliberately provocative, I think. And Tang Monk's reaction is instantaneous. And violent in its own way.
How so?
When Wukong rides up, holding the head, Tang Monk sees it and just breaks. He's completely aghast, pale with shock. He literally falls off his horse.
Falls off his horse.
And the first words out of his mouth are a curse. This wretched monkey is scaring me to death. Take it away. Take it away.
And someone does, right? Baji.
Yeah, Baji. Maybe for once doing something useful in a crisis, kicks the head off the road. And buries it quickly with his rake. Sha Seng helps Tang Monk up.
But Tang Monk isn't just scared. He's furious now, isn't he, once he gets his bearings?
Oh, absolutely furious. Once he's back on his feet, sort of collects himself on the ground, his mind goes straight to one thing, the tight Phyllis spell. Ah. He starts reciting.
And the effect on Wukong is always, well, agonizing. The source details it, right?
Painfully so. His ears go red, face flushes, eyes bulge, head spins. He's literally rolling on the ground in agony, just begging him to stop.
Just saying, stop reciting, stop reciting.
But Tang Monk doesn't stop, not right away.
No way. He is livid. He keeps going, reciting it, oh, more than 10 times. He doesn't stop.
Wukong must be in incredible pain.
Unbearable. He's reduced to pleading, despite all his power.
Yeah.
Master, forgive my crime. Just say what you need to say, but stop reciting. Stop reciting.
And only then, when Wukong is completely broken, does Tang Monk finally stop. Only then. And his first words are final. No ambiguity.
He tells him,
there's nothing more to say. I don't want you following me anymore. Go back. It's banishment. Pure and simple.
Wow. And does he explain why, lay out the reasons?
Oh, yes. He spells it out very clearly, drawing right from the source material, making his moral case. He calls Wukong too vicious, too fierce. And then the killer line, you are not a person fit for this scripture-seeking mission.
Ouch. That cuts deep, questioning his whole purpose.
Definitely. He even reminds Wukong about the bandits he killed just the day before. I already thought you were unkind for killing those two yesterday, so yeah, this has been building.
But killing Yang Sun was different.
That was the absolute final straw. And Tang Monk explains why it was so egregious. He points out their debt. You ranch it in his sorrow. We received food and shelter from him, and he saved our lives by letting us out the back.
Right, the father saved them.
Exactly. So even if the son was a bad guy, he hadn't actually done anything to them. And Wukong absolutely, Gukong, should not have just cut his head off like that.
So it's the specific context. Killing the son of their benefactor, the lack of direct provocation from the son himself in that moment.
Precisely. And he doesn't stop there. He condemns the wider killing too. Plus, you killed so many others, destroyed so many lives, you damaged the harmony of heaven and earth. He sees it as a cosmic disruption.
A disruption of harmony, that's a key aspect for Tang Monk.
It is. And his final accusation hits Wukong's character directly. I keep telling you, again and again, but you don't have a shred of good intention. What use are you to me? He sees Wukong as fundamentally lacking the necessary compassion.
Wow. He sees him as incorrigible.
Essentially, yes. And his last command is sharp, using the threat of the spell again. Go. Hurry before I recite the true words again.
He's using the pain to enforce the banishment.
He is. And Wukong, despite everything, is terrified of that pain. The source says he's afraid. His last words are just about stopping the recitation. Tuurk, stop reciting. I'm going.
And he just goes.
Just like that. Shab! One cloud somersault, no trace left, vanished. Gone.